The great Roman poet Virgil concludes the four books of his Georgics with an epilogue in which he says, "Thus I sang of the care of fields, of cattle, and of trees, while great Caesar thundered in war by deep Euphrates." This great poet was content to sing of fields and cattle and of trees, while the great Caesar thundered in war, in the conquest of other lands, in the expansion of his empire. He was content to sing of nature, of fields, trees, not because, I suspect, of his love of inglorious ease, but because the poet grasped intuitively a great truth, namely, that while many things change in the world, there are certain things which never change. Nature, the revolving seasons, the eternal life hunger of living things, death, and life reborn. There are certain things which endure, though empires rise and fall. There are underlying ideals which are indispensable to any age, regardless of its intellectual, political, or economic complexion. Whether an age is one of faith or reason or skepticism, whether in its economic arrangement it is capitalistic or socialistic, and its political organization democratic or dictatorial, there are certain basic moral assumptions which must be part of it. Without them, it cannot endure. They are what might be called mankind's eternal morality. Now, moderns sometimes glibly call this morality old-fashioned. And it is true that there is nothing startlingly clever or smart or heady or avant-garde about this morality. But it is everlasting. It is well to bear this in mind, this one fact. It is well to bear it in mind, namely, that new discoveries in the realm of morality or religion are extremely rare. Human nature has changed very little these thousands of years. And peaks of progress in these fields were reached long ago. And beyond the peak, you cannot climb. Man has known his inner life for a very long time. Man has experienced for a very long time love and hate, fear and frustration, bereavement, loss, and disillusionment. Man has experienced these things yesterday, 1,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago. All the emotions which the modern man experiences, men knew thousands of years ago. And the best minds among the ancients wrestled with the same problems of man's spiritual life quite as courageously as the best minds among the moderns. And frankly, we have not yet improved either upon the questions which they raised or upon the answers which they gave. Little that is really new can be added to the sum and the summit of moral truth, to the quintessential truth of the morality of mankind. What can you add, for example, to such postulates as love thy neighbor as thyself, or justice, justice shalt thou pursue, or ye shall do no unrighteousness in judgment, or they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and nations shall not lift up sword against nation. Now, one may suggest a better technique for the achievement or the realization of these ideals, for implementing them. But as far as their inherency is concerned, their content, very little can be added to them. Progress in the field of morality, unlike progress in the field of science, progress in the field of morality and ethics consists not in new discovery, but in greater fulfillment. From time to time, I read a book whose title suggests that the author has something really new to say on the subject of morality, morality in the New Age. Here perhaps is a new approach to morals. And I read such a book with great avidity to see if something new has really been discovered. But I find in every case that the author is only using new terminology, frequently borrowed from other disciplines. And when I look for his conclusions, what is he really driving at? What is he saying? I find that his conclusions are the same as those which are found in the pages of the ancient Bible, or the teachings of the rabbis of long ago, or of other sages and seers of other peoples, of other faiths. The newer data which he presents only corroborates an ancient wisdom. I'm afraid, dear friends, that there is really no new morality available. There are new immoralities available, but no new morality. We do not need a new Ten Commandments. What we need is to carry out the old Ten Commandments. Those commandments suffice for all ages. They remain forever the 10 digits, as it were, of civilization. And one should not look with disfavor upon a moral code just because it is old. One should accept it and live by it, even if one does not fully, personally approve of it. Some people believe that they must themselves recapitulate in their own lives all the moral experiences of the human race, and that they need not accept as binding moral principles which they themselves have not lived through and experimented with and found to be true. That is clearly impossible. No man can recapitulate in his own life the long moral experience of the human race. And the life of one individual is too short for that. It takes more than one life to test all the great moral findings of mankind. In our own moral life, we cannot begin at the beginning. We have to take certain ethical conclusions of mankind, certain ethical mandates, for granted. We must begin where the race left off, not where the race began, in the jungle. We must begin our moral life not with the primitive, but with the most exalted that has reached us through the ages. Some young people are inclined to reject the moral code which was given them as children, simply because they feel that they were indoctrinated with those ideas, and that there must be something, therefore, quite naive or immature about them. That is not so. Actually, we were indoctrinated with those moral ideas in our youth because the human race found those ideas and ways of life so vital, so essential, that it could not afford to lose time, and so began to train us from our very infancy into definite habits of moral conduct. Moral patterns which we were given as children are not moral prejudices, but the moral experiences which cover thousands and thousands of years. Mankind discovered at terrific cost and suffering that certain ways and only certain ways are conducive to the happiness of the individual and to the stability of society. These thoughts come to mind when we reflect on what maintains a home, on the pillars which maintain an enduring home, and when we discuss that subject on Mother's Day. The home is a very ancient institution, and while many changes have undoubtedly come over it, which affect the lives of all of its members and necessitate many serious adjustments, the morality which gives durability and effectiveness and harmony to the home has remained constant. No new functions have been assigned to the home, and no new roles to parents and children. There is no new morality at hand for 20th century men and women who are trying to build and maintain a happy home any more than there was for their forebears in the 12th century or in the 2nd century. The world in which they live, of course, is certainly different. The social, economic, and cultural factors which thrust and strike and impinge upon the integrity of family life today are certainly different, and they make the task of holding a family together in our day much more difficult. But these facts must simply act as an additional challenge to greater alertness and intelligence and forbearance on the part of all concerned in the family. It can certainly not serve as an excuse for abdication or resignation or submission. Granted that all life today is more involved, more complex, less stable, less secure, what should the answer be? Certainly not renunciation, not total collapse into spiritual and social chaos. The answer can only be an increased and more determined reinvigoration of our will and our spirits to meet the challenge of these new circumstances, to master them as man has mastered other challenges in the past. The fact which we frequently overlook is this: it is not enough to know what we are, why we are, and what are the circumstances under which we live, and then to use that knowledge as an excuse for inaction or submission. We must always keep before us the challenge of what we should be and can be. We must force ourselves to climb the steep hills of our higher destiny as children of God. It is only in this way that men and women can preserve the modern home. On the one hand, an awareness of the facts as they are, and on the other hand, a firm resolve to master them, a greater resolve, to resist the forces of disintegration. In the book of Proverbs, the Bible, which I would suggest that you read from time to time, it is the distilled wisdom of the ages that you find there. And sometimes in a very compact phrase or sentence, a world of wisdom is contained for our guidance. In the book of Proverbs we read, "Bechochmo yibane bayit." A home is built through wisdom. That's a remarkable saying. Through wisdom is a home built. And indeed, a happy home is never an automatic creation. The mere fact that people get married and have children does not automatically ensure for them a happy home. It takes much thought, and skill, and effort, and much, much else to build an enduring home. Now, the major responsibility, though not the sole responsibility, the major responsibility for maintaining a happy home, our seers and sages have placed upon the wife and mother. They knew that man is always ready to settle 10 cents on a dollar, morally speaking. And so they placed the major responsibility maintaining a happy home upon the wife and mother. That was not due to their chivalry. The ancient Hebrews seem, in fact, to have been the only chivalrous people of antiquity towards womankind. You may not have thought of that, but it is so. In no literature of the world, of the ancient world, and it produced great literature, do you find any such tribute, for example, to womanhood, as you find in the 31st chapter of the book of Proverbs, which was sung so beautifully this morning, Eshet Chayil Miyimtza. And mind you, there is no such tribute found in the Bible to manhood, to men. But when these, our forefathers, placed this major responsibility upon the woman in the home, upon wife and mother, and they looked upon her as the keystone and the arch of the enduring home, they spoke not merely out of chivalry, but out of great abiding wisdom. The mother makes the home. Beito zo ishto, said the rabbis. A man's home, that is his wife. The home is fundamentally woman's realm. Now, this is not to say that a woman's sphere is exclusively the home. It never was. Women always work inside the home, outside the home, side by side with her menfolk, in the field and on the farm, in the shop and in the factory, in the office and in the store, in the arts and in the sciences. Women is always work. There are millions of women in the United States today who are engaged in gainful occupation. So that while woman's domain is and ought to be as extensive as man's, it is nevertheless true. It nevertheless remains true that the chief interest and destiny of woman is the home. She is the home builder. It is around her that the home revolves. And the real criterion for the success of modern woman is not her ability to achieve equality with man. The real criterion of her success is the happy, harmonious home and a satisfying and enduring marriage relationship. As far as achieving equality with man is concerned, as far as status is concerned, the modern woman is certainly the equal of man in nearly all things. Even in the sphere of morals, woman has achieved the same standard as man, however dubious a victory that might be. We do not talk anymore today about a single standard as against a double standard of morality that used to be a moot question 40, 50 years ago. Today it is no longer a question, for the simple reason that there seem to be no standards of morality at all. The woman today is as free as the man is. When it comes to sowing wild oats, women today are as good farmers as men. They are free to choose their mates and other people's mates quite as much as men. They run to the divorce courts as quickly as men do, as often as men do, and sometimes oftener. They clamor for the right to live their own lives, whatever that may mean, quite as much as the pagan male does. On this court, at least, if on no other, woman today is the absolute equal of man. Which is not saying very much. And yet with all this equality, the modern woman does not appear to be quite as happy as she would like to be. Evidently, freedom, however desirable, is not enough. Evidently, freedom can become as heavy a burden and as sad a burden to carry as servitude. For after you get freedom, you've got to learn what to do with it. And women have not learned that secret any more than men have. The world of the modern woman has, I am afraid, more and not less of restlessness in it, more of frustration, more of insecurity, more of unhappiness than the world of the generations of women who had not acquired equality with men. The wise wife and mother in the home does not waste much time on such abstract and irrelevant matters as personal rights and equality. She is too busy to have much time left for neuroses. Women who insist on their Bill of Rights are on the way to a bill of divorcement. The wife and mother in the home must have more than her rights and must enjoy more than formal equality. The rabbi said that only a husband who loves his wife as himself and honors her more than himself will enjoy the confident knowledge that his tent is in peace. A husband should always observe the honor due to his wife. Mind you, they don't speak of rights and equalities, but of much more, much more. The husband should always observe the honor due to his wife, they declared, because blessings rest on a man's home only on account of his wife. Children who do not honor their mother have no mother. They may have a nurse and a servant and a housekeeper, but not a mother. For unless you honor a person, that person cannot teach you, cannot guide you, cannot serve you as model or example, and an unhonored person's love is held cheap in our eyes. A good home, my friends, is a little community which exists for the benefit of all of its members and for the benefit also of society. And the wise mother manages that little community, not obtrusively, not domineeringly, but lovingly. Strength and dignity are her spiritual raiment. Strength and dignity are her spiritual raiment. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the law of kindness is on her lips. As far as the home is concerned, the rabbis declared that the Holy One endowed the woman with more understanding than the man. But no home can be built by the mother alone, or can be made secure and happy by her efforts alone. Father and children have vital roles to play. A home is a cooperative achievement. A cooperative achievement. The father who brings nothing to the home but his tired self in the evening, the scraps and leavings of his exhausting business or professional day of work away from home, that father is not cooperating in the glorious enterprise of home building. He has built for himself and his household a motel. And even when that motel has a swimming pool, it is still only a motel. He is the absentee parent who asserts himself only when his wife or children cross him. At the crucial moments in his children's lives, when they need him, he's not there. He is the man who always complains, "I can't understand my children. I give them everything and look what they, how they treat me." Actually, he gives them nothing. The children really want to get from their parents. Love and unflagging interest, even in their trivial concerns and problems, guidance, direction, yes, even discipline when they need it. Above all, he failed to give them a parental image which they could honor, which they could take pride in. During the difficult years of their growth and their troubled physiological and social adjustments, the children had no one to turn to, no friendly hand to guide them. The Bible admonishes children to listen to the instruction of their fathers, but then there must be fathers at hand ready and qualified to give them instruction. Nor can mother and father alone build a home. Children too must cooperate. And not as a matter of duty, but as a matter of love, of eager sharing in a common enterprise which is for the good of all. Children will merely exploit their parents and use the home solely as a stepping stone to their own selfish careers, embitter the lives of father and mother, and fill the home with bitterness and recrimination. Mishadedav Yavriachem Ben Mevish Umachpir. A child, we read in the Bible, that deals shamefully and reproachfully in the home will despoil his father of the peace of his life and drive his mother to despair. And so I come to the conclusion. What are the seven pillars of an enduring home? Number is not important. In their old-fashioned morality, our forefathers named the following. First, a good beginning. Marry for love, not for money, not for position. He who marries for money, the rabbi said, will have unworthy children. That, of course, is clear, for the children, following the example of their parents, are likely also to be mere money grubbers or mere social climbers. A good beginning. Consider family, consider background. Consider whether the home into which the young man or the young woman is marrying is a home where the real values, the true values of life, are respected and revered. A home of honor, as well as a home of peace and integrity. A good beginning. And secondly, forbearance. No man or woman is perfect. People do make mistakes, sometimes very serious mistakes. In the first infatuation of romantic love, nothing short of perfection is assumed, but the inevitable flaws inherent in all human beings soon reveal themselves. And unless there is tolerance on both sides for these inevitable human shortcomings, unless husband and wife learn to overlook these shortcomings, unless they apply the healing balm of forgiveness to the hurts which are thoughtlessly or even sometimes deliberately inflicted, unless they come to regard an occasional incident of friction or misunderstanding or a quarrel as only as an emotional catharsis, which can really serve to cement more strongly a household. Unless they do that, unless they have the maturity or the development of the maturity to do that, an enduring home will never be established. And thirdly, fidelity. Where there is fidelity in a home, there is dignity. Where there is infidelity, there is furtiveness and indignity. And a pervading and corroding misery, which nothing, neither wealth nor comfort nor position can atone for or compensate for. And fourth, sharing all things, not on the basis of what is mine and thine, but on the basis of what is ours. Therefore, should a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. One flesh. Sharing. Sharing each other's life, each other's fortune, each other's joys and sorrows. Not all men succeed in their chosen callings. Not all men succeed all the time. Some succeed more than others. The happy home cannot depend upon such contingencies. Whatever a man's lot is, or a woman's, they must be valiantly faced and shared. For real devotion must overarch all of life's circumstances. Fair weather partnership in wedded life. Fair weather partnership in wedded life is an arrangement of convenience. It is no partnership at all. And fifth, reverence for everyone in the home, for father, mother, for child. However humble the home, it is still father's only domain of significance and importance in this world. It is mother's sole sanctuary. It is the child's really the one unfolding world. Everyone within the home must be shielded in his prerogatives. Let each live up to his full importance. Let children develop into their gradual independence. No one's personality must be crushed or submerged. As in all reverent relationships, there are things which may be done and may not be done. There must be voluntary discipline. There are times for saying yes, and a time for saying no, and boundless permissiveness is even more harmful than senseless prohibition. And sixth, social mindedness. A family is part of the larger family, which is society. It exists not for itself alone, but for society. It is a private world, to be sure, but within a public setting. What happens within it is ultimately reflected in the community, just as communal standards and currents ultimately affect it. Hence, a home should be the training ground for socialized personalities. Parents should set a good example of social mindedness. Emphasis on the wrong thing in the home. Emphasis on the wrong thing in the home. On display, on indulgence, on snobbery, on status seeking is a poor example. Children should be raised in such a way that they will come to think not only of themselves, but of themselves in relation to their surrounding, to their community. They should be trained in good neighborliness and in good citizenship. And parents, by their example, by their participation in civic and philanthropic activities and causes, can set the example. I've always wondered what the rabbis meant when they said, let your home be wide open and let the poor be welcome to your home. I understand now. Let your home be such a home that your children will come to understand that there are all kinds of people in the world, rich and poor, those who have and those who have not. And that we all have a mutual responsibility one to another. Let your home be wide open and let the poor be welcome to your home. And finally, piety. Piety. Word seldom used today. Piety is a strong cement for an enduring home. It brings a grace and a spiritual beauty into the life of the members of a family, creates a holy bond of union among its members. Family ritual in the home, family prayer, lend an element of nobility to the home. Children, when they grow up into young manhood, womanhood, and even later in life, children, when they grow up, never forget the picture of their mother blessing her Sabbath lights, or of their father leading them, not sending them, mind you, in a carpool, but leading them to the temple, religious school. The way to instruct a child in the way that he should go is to go that way yourself. Well, these are the seven pillars which our forebears, in their old-fashioned morality, recommended for a good and happy home. Can you think of any newer or better ones? Well, think about it.